Millennium, a history of our last 1,000 years. Food, a history. Ideas that change the world. Humankind, a brief history. The world, a global history. You enjoy not the nuggets of history, or not necessarily, or perhaps the nuggets, but how those nuggets add up to what has changed us. You take broad views.
Well, thank you very much, Carl. I'll take that as a compliment. It's slightly worrying hearing someone in a state famous for its chickens speaking of nuggets. I mean, I think I prefer to speak of bricks, building great edifices out of bricks. Salvador de Madariaga, one of my countrymen who's a great historian, said there are two kinds of historians. There are brick makers and there are architects. But you know, you can't have these great edifices without both. So I try to put together the structures devised by the great minds of those historical architects and the bricks provided by the nitty-gritty researchers who are out there, you know, in the archives getting the dust into the pores of their skin and into their hair and picking the living worm out of the documents as they go. And I try to put those things together and construct, you know, I don't know, interesting edifices which invite the reader in and give the reader a chance to explore some great historical problems. Yeah, they all sound like hugely ambitious books, but the high that proved too high and the heroic for earth too hard. I think ambition's a good thing, even if it's unfulfilled.
The book 1492, The Year the World Began. Anyone who went to schooling in the Western Hemisphere knows 1492, Christopher Columbus. But when you start reading this book and you realize there's Ivan the Great, there's the Aztecs, there are the Incas, there's so much happening in that year. What first led you to that 1492 year as a concept for the book?
That's a very difficult question because obviously I've thought about this problem for a very long time. I think in a way, ever since I was a little schoolboy, as listeners will tell from my English, I went to school in England. And one of my earliest memories is being told that the modern world began in 1494. The year 1492 has this great resonance, and it's been a long-standing problem for historians, this problem of periodization. What do we mean when we say that one period ends and another begins, and how far can you pinpoint these transitions? People used to talk about turning points in history. And I've always been interested in what was happening in 1492, particularly since I was a young professor at Oxford, and I had to teach people about Columbus. We had a paper which was very heavily based on the study of Columbus's own writings, and as a result of having to teach it, I became interested in being a teacher's a great education. So I guess that it's a combination of those things which brought me to 1492, but I have to say that I had a very specific piece of inspiration from a great professor of history at the University of Arkansas, Robert Finlay, with whom I coincided on a maritime history course many years ago. We were together on this course in Providence, Rhode Island. And he said something to me which has resonated in my mind ever since. He said, suppose Columbus had been right. Suppose the world that Columbus imagined, a small world with no America, had really been there. Suppose you really could get from Europe to China in one voyage, with nothing in between. What difference that would have made to the history of the world? Europe would have gone on just being a poor satellite and client of the Chinese. We wouldn't be having this terrible experience we're having now, getting terribly worried about the resurgence of China, because China would never have retreated. So that's one of the things that makes that year really special in the history of what a really transforming, a really transmutative year in which everything changes. Just give you one or two examples. Perhaps the biggest change which has happened in the world since human beings began interfering in the environment is what historians call the Columbian Exchange, or the ecological revolution. Until 1492, the world had been experiencing divergent evolution. By which I mean that continent by continent, all the life forms, all the biota, all the foodstuffs, all the plants, all the animals, all the microbes had been getting more and more unlike each other. And you've got a completely different ecology in the Americas from in Eurasia or Africa or Australasia. Then suddenly, in 1492, that divergent process of evolution goes into reverse. It had been happening for something like 130, maybe 150 million years. And when you get 130, 150 million years of history suddenly being reversed, and ever since then we've had a convergent experience of evolution in the world, and the life forms of different parts, different land masses have grown more and more like each other ever since. That's a huge deal. I don't think that such a huge ecological transformation has ever happened in such a short space of time before in the entire history of the planet. And then if you look at, you know, something that people are very interested in at the moment in the world, the way that what we now call civilizations are distributed, and we're very interested at the moment, particularly in the relationship between Christendom and Islam. Until 1492, Christendom and Islam were both cultures which were very specific to particular environments, particular parts of the world. Suddenly, in 1492, Christendom leaps across the Atlantic, gets implanted in a completely different kind of environment from that in which it had historically, you know, bred and grown up. It also leaps across the Sahara into sub-Saharan Africa with the foundation of the first Christian kingdom in Equatorial Africa, which is the kingdom of Christian kingdom of Congo. In just about the same moment, something very similar happens in Islam, which also leaps across the Sahara. Muhammad Turayaskia becomes the emperor of Songhai and implants Islam. From that moment on, you know, the destiny of Islam as a trans-Saharan religion is really irreversible. So it's at that moment, just the same way we have this huge ecological transformation, we've got this huge civilizational transformation in which Christendom and Islam begin to play the role of great world religions, inter-environmental religions that they have to this day. And you know, I'd say it's a third great example of the transformation of the world in this single prodigious year is the way the discovery of America opens up for the West a huge new resource base to exploit. That means that the traditional balance of wealth and power in the world, which had always favored China, India, Islam, the civilizations around the Indian Ocean, and which had left Europe as a, you know, marginal, poor relation out in a neglected corner of the world, despised by everybody else, that situation becomes a thing of the past, and the world that we've experienced ever since, the world of the rise of the West, becomes possible as a result of all those resources being available for Western exploitation for the first time.
You opened the book, 1492, the year the world began, with this recounting of a prophet who came to the streets, I believe, of Rome,
yes,
and made a prediction. And generally when you see that in a book start, this is going to give us insight. And in the second paragraph, you've already wiped that out, said, this guy couldn't have been more wrong. And it gives us this insight that everything is about to change.
Yes, I suppose that was a bit of a shallow technique to start the book that way. I mean, I think it's very important. I don't know what you think or what your listeners think is the mark of a good history book. For me, good historical writing is distinguished by vividness. It's by that power of taking the reader into the period that the historian is trying to describe and giving one a flavour of what it felt to be there. And that's why I do, although I write these sort of sweepingly ambitious, on these sweepingly ambitious subjects, always try to home in on the lives and experiences of real individuals. And, I mean, I start with that prophet, but I mean, on the whole, the book is constructed around the stories of travellers. As you rightly say, that we associate this year with Columbus, and properly say, because Columbus is, of course, tremendous, unrivaled importance. But he's not the only person who's undertaking the most fabulous and most incredible journeys across the face of the planet in that year. And so in the course of the book, you know, we we crossed the Indian Ocean with another Italian traveler of the time called Girolamo di Santo Stefano. We crossed the Sahara with Leo Africanus, one of the refugees from the conquest of Granada by Spain. We go back and forth around the Mediterranean with Jews who were expelled from Spain in 1492. We cross the marchlands between Poland and Russia with ambassadors of Ivan the Great. And, of course, we cross the Atlantic with Columbus. I'm always trying to take the reader along, you know, in the company of these great travelers and build up a picture of what the world was like and how it hung together. We also go to China, of course, with a Korean shipwreck victim, which I think is an interesting excursion. Enable people to see what China, the great cynosure of the world's like, the great hegemon, the great superpower of the time. And to go there with a Korean shipwreck victim is quite a great way of doing this, because he looks around China with these wide eyes.
You get excited by history. It's obvious. Do you find when you give a lecture or a discussion like the one you're giving at the University of Arkansas that that's what you want to inject to the listeners? Or are you assuming that since they're coming to you, they're already excited about history?
It's nice of you to imply that students are already excited about history. In the United States, one of the things that I've learned, you know, from being a teacher and or trying to be a teacher in the United States. I don't like to call myself a teacher because it implies that my students actually learn something. But as a result of doing the job, I have discovered that, you know, it is very unusual in a history class to have history majors. It makes the time, you know, you're talking to people in other disciplines. And I do find that really interesting and really stimulating. I can learn so much, you know, from a student who's a pre-med student. I learn about medicine from him or her, or from an engineer. And I find it really exciting to have these most daily interdisciplinary encounters in the classroom. And of course, my own work is itself very interdisciplinary, and I'm always drawing on anthropology. I'm now drawing very heavily on the sciences, and the you know, hard sciences. The lecture that I was lucky enough to come to Arkansas to give is very much the result of my own turn towards biology and primatology. I now try to understand human culture in the context of other life forms, other cultural organisms, other cultural animals. So I think that interdisciplinarity is something absolutely to relish, and it's transformed my own way of thinking about the world. But it does mean that the students sometimes come to class not really wanting to be there at first.
At first. Thank you so much for your time.
On the contrary, it's really nice of you to have me.